What is going on, ladies and gentlemen? I want to thank you for coming over here to check out the Warrior Soul Podcast. This is where we talk about tools, tactics, ideas, and issues to help active duty military members and U.S. military veterans and anybody else who's willing to listen to live their best lives. And today's guest is somebody we've had on the podcast before, Dr. Michael Robillard. Dr. Robillard, or Michael as I call him, he is a graduate of West Point. He served as a U.S. Army officer in the infantry, and then he went on to get his PhD in philosophy from the University of Connecticut. Since then, he's become a fellow over at the University of Oxford in England, and he studies war and ethics. And he goes around and he trains different military organizations in war and ethics and decision making. And he brings a really awesome and unique perspective to everything. Having been a soldier and having been a philosopher, he's able to really comment on both. He started his own podcast that I highly recommend along with his partner, Lieutenant Colonel Bob Underwood. And They started the Homo Furins podcast, and that is a podcast about war and ethics and war in society. So you guys should definitely go check that out. I'm going to link it in the show notes below. Before we get into our conversation with Michael, I want to tell you about a new project I've been working on for Warrior Soul, and that is the Warrior for Life newsletter. I alluded to this a couple of years ago. I wanted to create something that was going to help men in the veteran community to take their rightful place as leaders in this society. And the best place, in my opinion, to start with this is to help men to begin taking care of their own bodies. So what you're going to find in Warrior for Life is a place where you can connect with others on the same path as you, and the best information and tips you can get on improving your health, fitness, and mental fortitude. And it's completely free. And when you sign up, you get a free testosterone optimization checklist, a free 21-day testosterone boosting workout, and you get access to our community, the Warrior Soul Fitness Academy. And that's where you can connect with other veterans and other people who are trying to live their best lives as well. And so I'll put a link for that in the show notes as well. You guys should definitely check that out. And just one more note from our awesome sponsor, F-Bomb Nutrition. They make delicious, awesome packets of fats. And this one here is macadamia nut butter mixed with coconut butter. And it is absolutely delicious. I eat a couple of these things every single day. It's a great way to fuel yourself up. There's no sugar in them. And like I said, they taste great. Warrior Soul listeners get 20% off of their first order when they go to www.dropanfbomb.com and they use the code Warrior Soul at checkout. So definitely go check these guys out. Great stuff. And they're doing great things for the veteran community. They're sending packages of these things overseas to the front lines, to troops who are deployed. And Ross and Kara are great people. So again, definitely go check them out. With that, I'm going to stop yapping my trap over here, and we'll get into our conversation with Dr. Michael Robillard on the Warrior Soul Podcast. This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's a solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. We need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason: to live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast. What's going on, Michael? How you doing, man?
Not too bad. How you doing?
Good, good. So you're out there at the University of Oxford in England, right?
And yes, I am. And it's surprisingly sunny today. A rare occasion.
So, what do you do? Yeah. What do you do without the sun? Like, because I've been out there a bit. And it's I love England. I think it's awesome, but I can't imagine living there long term without, you know, having the sun all the time.
Yeah, I mean, the answer is I pop lots of vitamin D pills and I have a vitamin D light, and I try to travel as much as I can to somewhere sunny in the wintertime. Yeah, because it wears down on you in ways that you wouldn't expect. It's not like a immediate sort of thing, but over several months, I think it really starts to steal your capacity to focus and to have high energy.
Yeah. Do you think it affects people's moods over there? Like, I know in the Northeast, people around the country say, you know, people from the Northeast have an edge or something like that to them. You know, I'm from Connecticut, you're from Massachusetts, but, you know, does it affect people's moods over there? Because everybody I met over there seemed like really friendly, really awesome. But
yeah, I mean, it affects my mood. I'd rather live in a place where there was snow but some amount of sun versus no snow and no sun. And I think even the little bits of sun that you get in the Northeast, it actually does a lot of good. Whereas around here, if it's so cloudy, it really can wear you down.
Yeah. I mean, you got to think about that, because the Northeast, they settled there for a reason. You know, it's one of the first places they settled in the United States. And the weather was, I mean, I've been through a New England winter, but
yeah.
You know, the weather was more climate friendly than apparently what they came from. So It's interesting stuff. So what's going on in your world right now, as far as things go with you know, the things you're studying, the things you're looking at?
I'm juggling I have several projects that I'm running and then several of them trying to start up. The main one that I'm here for is a 4-year project on the ethics of counterterrorism. So we're looking at everything from the ethics of targeted killing to preventative detention to how privacy rights trade off against mass surveillance to considerations of suspension of civil liberties in terrorist effort or counterterrorist efforts, and questions of I guess cultural integration as a possible counter radicalization feature. You know, what are the ethical elements of that? So it has, you know, a variety of, you know, really difficult ethical issues in both the domestic and military spaces that we're trying to think carefully about, and then hopefully translate these sort of high church principles into something that is actionable policy guidance with respect to strategy, law, and institutional redesign.
You work with certain military organizations too, and kind of school them up on these things as well.
Occasionally I'll be brought in to talk to various institutional agencies about what they, what it is, what ethical situations that their practitioners are dealing with. And then just to kind of give them my 20,000 foot view to say, hey, you know, here are some frameworks that, and some ethical lenses that you can use to kind of give some concepts and better language to your practitioners as they're either about to go into a particular situation or thinking retrospectively on past decisions that they've made. Maybe these concepts can help them make, you know, better sense of some of the murky ethical spaces that they've already been in.
So, like in a typical kind of, I know that this stuff can get like deep, like as far as rabbit holes and that kind of stuff. But like in a typical kind of situation, what? Because you have a history as a U.S. Army officer, and then you're approaching it from this kind of helicopter view too. What would you go back and tell yourself on deployment that you know now?
I would say probably. It's a really good question. I would say probably think more about how ethics connects up with political theory and how that connects up with an extension, how military and foreign policy connects up with various political theories, and how that there's more of a seamless connection between the ethics, the politics, and the military than I imagined. When I was younger, I kind of regarded these things as being very sort of compartmentalized. And, you know, on strong readings of a traditional just war theory, a lot of people think that it's just not a soldier's business to consider what it is the politics are that are informing the war that they're fighting. And I mean, to a certain point, you're not going to have a military if everybody's always questioning the politics of every single thing, right? So I can understand the potential value of that. But at the same time, I think in retrospect, I wish that I was a bit more astute and questioning of the politics behind the invasion of Iraq, for instance. And, you know, I'm not sure if my decisions would have changed as a young officer at that time, but at least just to, you know, it's one of the regrets that I have, I suppose.
As far as like questioning the validity of the war or questioning, you know, your own actions in the conduct of that war.
Not even, well, I guess both, but it's less even, what I was referring to was maybe just exercising more due diligence in just reading more journal articles, reading more views from the media, intentionally exposing myself to conflicting views. Gotcha. To, you know, kind of just maintain that epistemic humility. And yeah, I think that's what I would have liked to have done more of prior to deploying. And then there's a whole host of other things in theater that I wish I'd done differently too.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept because I think if you're reading one news outlet, especially these days, and you're only reading that particular news outlet, a lot of times that's an echo chamber. And, yep. You know, if you're going to get completely different perspectives, if you go from CNN to like Fox News to like MSNBC to Al Jazeera to BBC, all of these different outlets, they have their own kind of spin on things. And I think, you know, prior to you know, this current presidency, I'd never seen that as strong as it is now. I mean, you go to CNN, you get a completely different reading from any other news outlet. And then you go to Fox News, it's different. And then you go to Al Jazeera, it's completely different. And in some ways it's weird because Al Jazeera seems almost more even-handed on our own policy than you know, CNN or Fox News does.
They're not, because they're in less of a competitive battle with an opponent.
Yeah, it's insane. Where do you think that's coming from, man? What do you think's going on?
I would like, so here's a pseudoscientific theory. I would liken it almost to something like the creation of going from spoken language to written language, or going from written language to the printing press, or going from printing press to the radio, or the radio to television. In each of these epochs, you know, when you saw a jump to the printing press, for instance, at the same time, that's sort of on the back end of that was the Protestant Reformation, in virtue of this sort of expansion and diaspora of knowledge that could occur because of this new medium of communication. Mm-hmm. And then with that, you saw a various sort of plurality of views emerging. Then likewise with radio, likewise with television, you saw these sort of jumps in terms of each of these technological mediums provided an opportunity for new actors and new speakers to voice new ideas that weren't accessible before. I mean, I'll give you one example. Ayatollah Khomeini was a fringe figure in Iran prior to the advent of the cassette tape. But then once the cassette tape came out, you know, he could record his sermons on a very small and portable device and spread those around quite easily. And that, you know, that created a tremendous amount of political upheaval that was not anticipated at all. And I think we're in a similar sort of space right now, where the old mediums of print journalism, of getting your news through, you know, cable television, that those hierarchies have begun to wither and begun to level. Sadly, I'd say the same thing about academia too. So what ends up happening is that there's a trade-off between vertical expertise that's very narrow, but as that withers, there's more opportunity for more voices, but then it's very difficult to sort out, well, where are the experts anymore within this sort of cacophony of ideas and cacophony of views. So in the maelstrom of all that, I think people just sort of circle wagons around whatever view or set of ideologies that they find most comfortable with. And I'm not even sure to what extent that's even conscious. It might just be a feature of, you know, the five people that you hang around with most, or your coworkers, or what you listen to on YouTube for fun, that like that actually could be the formation for like an entire worldview.
Well, I think it's interesting too, because, you know, you're talking about this kind of Gutenberg style, you know, revolution as far as media goes. And with podcasting, for example, very different from what you got on the nightly news. I mean, you know, this is longer form. You have the opportunity to express longer form ideas rather than like 2 minute sound bites. And what it seems to me is that, in some ways, these more complicated ideas, these more nuanced ideas, which wouldn't have been threatening before, are now like seeming like they're threatening at people. And you know, a good example of that is like Jordan Peterson, right? Mm-hmm. And what I think happened,
him and Sam Harris were here last week in London. Like, I don't know if they sold out, but they packed the house.
Yeah,
Academy, that's normally like a sporting, you know, music venue.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, I think it's weird because, people categorize, you know, Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson as like these alt-right people, kind of super conservative, but they're not conservative. They're, you know, neoclassical.
They're classic liberals.
Yeah. And so the thing is, it's like, I think what's going on there is that you have this mix of things where some people are trying to utilize the old media way of doing things, where they're paraphrasing and giving like these short sound bites and not giving a very nuanced view of the picture. And some people only want to listen to that. And then others are giving a more complicated view of things, but it's interesting how that information is being twisted and turned for certain causes, right? So like the people who consider, you know, Peterson and Harris to be threatening, they're focusing on those sound bites and they're utilizing a lot of the weapons of the old media to try to mischaracterize what they're saying.
Yeah, yeah. And you can imagine somebody, if, I mean, look, we all are sort of caught up in this information overload age. And, you know, we only have so many hours in the day to do what we care about and to try to focus on our projects that we regard as meaningful. So you got to delete and filter certain things out. And so we need to, you know, take certain informational shortcuts on something. So if one's initial exposure to hearing about Jordan Peterson is that he, you know, he's an alt-right neo-fascist or you know, whatever the stigma is, and that's the first thing that you end up hearing about this guy, then
if I'm going about my day, it's probably not on my top of my list to spend 3 hours to really, really tunnel into the nuances of somebody's views who prima facie has been called an alt-right fascist, right? Mm-hmm. There's very pragmatic reasons why people might at first hand dismiss Peterson and Harris based upon these sort of just these labels. You know, it's a shortcut. It's a time-saving device to just categorize them as, oh, that's what those guys are. I don't have to bother myself with digging into that abhorrent view. But then it turns out that a lot of the time this is just mudslinging and a radical mischaracterization of a lot of these views.
But, you know, and I got to ask you this, because you're somebody as a philosopher who deals with nuance. I mean, like that's your bread and butter, right?
That's we split hairs just to right. split hairs. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, what's that feel like for you? You know, being in a time and place where you can't really, you know, you can't really color yourself in a black or white argument, and in a time and place where these types of views are easily getting mischaracterized, you know, what does that feel like for you as somebody who is an academic who deals in this kind of nuance?
Yeah. Yeah. It's complicated. I mean, I see some things that, like my Facebook feed looks like a schizophrenic person, because, you know, I have, you know, friends that are more conservative leaning, largely from my military days. And then I have friends and colleagues, that are more left-leaning from my academic career. And, you know, I think I've always sort of been oddly just in the center of these things, trying above all to exercise due diligence and to give every argument its fair due and to try to treat the reasons and the arguments on their own merits. So seeing some of the... Seeing some of my non-academic friends see some of the moves that Peterson and Sam Harris make, and they're like, oh my God, these guys, this is the most brilliant dialogue I've ever heard in my life. And I go, well, you know, they're making some good points, but, you know, they're skipping some steps, or they're being loose and fast with a couple of concepts that, you know, like I kind of find frustrating. But at the same time, more on the academic side, I feel that, you know, Peterson and Harris might get dismissed as not being worthy of being listened to at all, because they're, you know, they don't have the because they have these stigmas put on them. You know, so I think they do make some good points. But like I said, I think I'm just kind of caught in a sort of bizarre middle space trying to adjudicate either side.
Yeah, but there's some people out there that would say that even by giving them a platform, or even by giving credit to their views at all, you're
legitimizing
it. Yeah, and you're reinforcing the patriarchy, and you're, you know, reinforcing the tyranny and all this stuff like that. You know, what would you say to that?
I guess I just, maybe I've Pollyanna glasses on, but I think I have more faith in human reasoning and human rationality to be able to hear bullshit when they hear it, right? And to be able to work to not fall under the spell of a bunch of propaganda or rhetoric or sophistry. So I'm very much of the view, you know, let persons articulate their reasons and let their arguments sort of stand and fall on their own merits, and let the morons speak and get their voices out so that you can recognize them and then maybe even correct some of their thinking. So that's what my understanding of what I think a functional academia should be. It should be a place of controversial views. Even sometimes very unsavory views. Doesn't mean we have to celebrate these things, right? But I don't think it's the type of thing that would warrant official institutional censorship.
I think that what's weird about us as human beings is that certain extremist types of thinking, they're really intoxicating, right? And both on the left and the right, right? So, in colleges these days, we see a lot of people running around with Che Guevara shirts on and communism, pro-communism, yep, kind of things. We saw the rally in Charlottesville,
yep,
Virginia, with white guys walking around with tiki torches and things like that, and calling, yep, themselves white supremacists. but in my mind, the media looks at these things in two different ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that when we look at Charlottesville, we think evil. When we look at, the kid in the Che Guevara shirt, in my mind, I see, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth at all on this, but in my mind, I see an ignorant kid who's promoting somebody who was a mass murderer, who was, factually a mass murderer. Why do we look at these things in different ways? And why are human beings so attracted to those extremes, like moss to a light bulb?
Yeah, I mean, one might even look at these things as surface structures of just a greater desire for people to want to belong to something bigger than themselves, right? So you could conceivably throw in any sort of pernicious, like, tight in-group into that mix. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, a lot of the motivation behind ISIS recruitment is probably the psychology behind it is probably very similar to a lot of the recruitment on the far left and far right. And I think it appeals to a more general desire within the human condition to want to be part of something bigger than oneself, and to want to be part of a group that is for something and thereby against something else. And then, there are ready-made narratives on the left and right that organize one's life quite easily along those lines, whether it's class solidarity or race solidarity or something along that. But as we've talked about before, the simplicity of that is it's dangerous, but it's you can also see how inviting that is to somebody who just doesn't want to think that much, that they don't want to think about the nuances. They just go, give me my ideology, give me my received views. Okay, this is who I am. We're the good guys. Those are the bad guys. The end. I mean, that there's something very psychologically mean. It generates meaning and purpose and identity for a lot of folks.
I think in a lot of ways, particularly for those who've never served in the military, it feels good to feel like you're fighting evil. Just what you're saying, and it probably goes back to us. When we were cavemen living in small groups,
yep,
the person who saw the saber-toothed tiger lurking around the village was probably a hero, right? Or the person who saw the poisonous snake, or all these things, they probably got lauded and rewarded for those types, yep, of things. And I think it goes back to that. And so, we have a generation of young people who most of whom have never known military life or violent life, right? It's less. We've had a lot of people serving overseas and everything like that, but the population percentage is less than it's ever really been during a war. And so we get a lot of people out there who are looking for their own fight, their own battle, their own thing to do. And I think it goes back to that.
Yeah, I think so. There is something really primal that might be activated with these types of ideologies. And you wonder to what degree is the tail wagging the dog in those scenarios, right? Do folks really, really believe in these ideologies, or they just want to be the hero and want to have a narrative of defending the group, and they help themselves to whatever ideology most allows for that. I don't know, but I'd imagine sometimes it's probably a little of both.
Yeah, it's just this interesting thing because, when you got, and I can go deep into some different facets of this, but, you take kids who've been raised in Western lifestyle, who have everything they ever needed, got sent to, a top line college that costs a ridiculous amount of money per year, and then carrying around an iPhone and iPad and all these different things, but railing against capitalism. I mean,
right. Yeah.
It's insane. And the logic, it almost defies logic, but if you look at it from those other terms where they're actively going out there looking for something to fight, it becomes a little bit more sensical, I guess, from a animal behavior standpoint.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I might have mentioned this in the last podcast, but William James, the pragmatic philosopher and really one of the founders of psychology in the early 1900s, wrote a paper called The Moral Equivalent of War. And he talks about how war would be the ultimate sport were it not the case that it had so much suffering and dying attached to it. And it's the type of thing for the modern mind that has become somewhat of a surrogate for maybe a what would have been a tribal initiation ritual in earlier times. And I wonder if something like that similarly might be going on, where if it's not necessarily combat anymore, it's some heroic struggle against something, fill in the blank. And maybe this is me projecting a bit, but I would imagine if like a lot of young men, if they're looking for some dragon to fight and conquer and to go back to the village victorious, where are the dragons anymore, right? It's not in the form of the rival tribe or the tiger or the physical elements either, right? There's no real physical frontier to conquer. So I wonder to what degree, people start looking for something that looks similar to that. And some of these more far right and far left ideologies provide the conceptual categories that then generate the enemy that they can then vanquish.
Yeah, that's it's a weird concept, man. And you gotta think what it's like to be young and to what was that that band? It had this lyric. It was called "Against Me." And
okay, I remember those guys.
Yeah. Remember those guys? Yeah. Interestingly, the lead singer, she transgendered, but they had this crazy lyric. It was a what's it called? I was a teenage anarchist, looking for a revolution, and then it talks about, do you remember when you're young and you wanted to set the world on fire? I mean, like, that's pretty much what it comes down to. I mean, like,
yeah. Well, I mean, Heidegger talks about, he has this notion of thrownness, right? We're just thrown into the world, and we become conscious to realize that the play of humanity has already started without us, and mm-hmm. We just kind of have to figure out what the hell is going on, but there's really no there's no agency or administrator that we can go to and say, what's my role, how did I get here? And what ends up happening, I think, a lot of time, particularly for adolescents, is that everything, you didn't decide on any of this, right? There are all these institutional mechanisms in place telling you what to do, who you are, and you had you had no say in the legitimacy of any of it. Right. So I can imagine, you know, for, more sort of rebellious youths, there's like a true sentiment behind that of like, why do I have to follow any of these rules that I had no autonomous say in whatsoever?
Yeah.
But then as you get older, you realize, oh, well, maybe there's a good reason to keep certain things in place. There was some wisdom behind why they put that line there and that other line over there.
I think too, I mean, we empirically overweigh our importance in other people's minds and, mm-hmm. and our impact on the world. And I think that in a lot of ways, you have to get to a point where you understand that the world doesn't revolve around you. It revolves, you know, you're a very small part of this world. And there's power in that because it keeps you from having to worry about a whole lot of shit that you used to worry about, right? So if you just focus on your own life, if you focus on you rather than being negative about the things you can't control, mm-hmm. and you can have more control over your life and you can do things with your life without constantly worrying or constantly living in fear or things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important for young people to realize. You're not as important as you think you are. That's something in the military I learned very quick. Very, very quickly. I wonder what could be done to get young people to understand that and to realize that. But the thing is, when you head off to college, it's like, oh, you're so smart. You're going to go out there. You're going to have an impact on the world and everything like that. And you're going to, you know, make your stamp here and make your stamp there. You know, I think a lot of people, we get told that from the time we're kids and mm-hmm. you know, that's what happens. You know, people go in and when they find that they don't have that impact or that they, that the world isn't the way they want it to be, then they get mad.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because the narrative is that there all the effort and student loans will therefore generate a meaningful livelihood on the back end of it. And I mean, maybe at some point that existed. I don't know if it was always so rocky or if that was a more accurate narrative that mapped onto the world at some point, but now maybe it's a bit outmoded. I don't know, but yeah, you end up with an entire generation of folks that they go along that arc, and then there's, I don't know, the promised job or the promised career at the back end isn't, it's either not there at all or it's not the utopian sort of thing that they imagined it to be.
Yeah. I think at one time going to college was this like your key to going up the hierarchy, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
At one point, but now we're seeing that it could actually be a hindrance in some cases. I'm not saying every case, mm-hmm. but in some cases it can be because you then take on student loans. So,
yep.
And all of a sudden people who took out these student loans, they think that, the world is unfair. I wasn't, you know, I'm being kept down by having to pay these.
By the way, that must be the 1% that tricked me.
Something
like that.
Yeah, exactly. The 1% tricked me, but literally they realize they are the 1%.
You know?
I mean, anybody making above, I think, what is it? What is one of your colleagues says it? It's, I think anybody making above $33,000 a year is above the 1%, right?
Oh, yes, probably Will McCaskill talking about the effective altruism.
Effective altruism.
Anything over 30,000, you're living quite comfortably in the developed world. You're not, you know, experiencing any degree of poverty nothing comparable to what poverty looks like elsewhere.
Yeah. He must have gotten a really good deal when he went out and did his PhD. Not had to take out any student loans whatsoever.
The British system might be a bit different over here. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's awesome. But yeah, man, I, I mean, I really, I don't know. I mean, I look at young people today. I really hope, well, I know that a lot of them have their heads screwed on tight. I know that there's a minority of them that don't. And the problem is we're seeing the minority out there that do not, who are making the most noise and getting themselves, you know, into the spotlight. And I think, it's always interesting how, you know, I think the media skews these kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah, I think that there's, once again, with like the new media of social media, I think that throws like a huge curveball into one's felt sense of existence and way of being in a way that you and I never experienced. So I know millennials get like a really hard time for, you know, always being addicted to their phones and addicted to social media. But I mean, I have no clue what the like amount of, you know, Foucault's panopticon like pressures that it must feel like growing up as an adolescent with social media. I was super paranoid in a 200 graduating class of 200 people. I was super paranoid as a kid, one, you know, worrying about curating my social image in a way that I wasn't looked at as a nerd or I wasn't bullied. Now I can't imagine how mentally sort of vigilant one would be at that age, knowing that like every photo, everything you say, everything you do on social media, it's on the internet forever. That's a different type of social world and with a different set of obstacles.
Yeah, I don't think I would get into this age without getting arrested. I mean, and just being honest, I think like if half the things I did were chronicled, I would have been screwed over.
Right,
I might have walked a more straight and narrow path too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just knowing that I was being watched, I could not, and this is going to sound really, really bad, but I could not imagine getting from the ages of 12 to 15 in the age of internet porn. I don't think I would have gotten anything done whatsoever.
Yeah,
no.
yeah. There were less distractions back then, I would have to say.
Yeah.
So I think millennials get a bad rap for being so addicted to technology and so focused on social media. But like a part of me gets it. Like I would be very vigilant and trying to manage that type of stuff too. If your whole life, your whole social world is mediated through the phone, it only makes sense to pay attention to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Got to jump off in a second, man. But as far as interesting things you're seeing out there, like, and as you know, we got a lot of soldiers and Marines listening to this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think people should be paying attention to? What do you think people should be trying to set their minds on? Books, podcasts, guides, anything?
Well, I could shamelessly start plugging my own stuff right now, but I'll
go ahead.
I think the Oxford Yehira Center for Security Ethics and military ethics stuff. That's always good.
Well, dude, yeah, I mean, like you're former army officer, you know, philosopher, and you train in this stuff, and I think people should pay attention. So, absolutely,
yeah, we'll
keep that in the show notes.
Within that space, yeah, I got a podcast with Bob Underwood, who's a lieutenant colonel in the Army and a philosopher. So our podcast is called Homo Furens, which is taken from J. Glenn Gray's The Warriors. And he talks about Homo Furens being a subspecies of Homo sapien. You know, so it's the soldier, I guess, literally translated into like furious ape or warring ape. But the idea being that you metaphysically change once you go to combat. So we talk about war and society stuff on that. And we did a crossover with Chris recently. As far as other things, I, in this same sort of vein of understanding political discourse and social discourse in this new age of new media, I like a lot of Michael Lynch's stuff. He has a TED Talk on big data and on how it is we can exercise epistemic humility in this sort of cacophony of different voices. And he does a lot of stuff on testimony and fake news as well. So I think, I mean, he's technically an epistemologist, but in order to have any sort of political discourse, we need to have an accurate notion of what are the facts first. So underpinning any of these sort of battles between different media and journalistic camps are going to be a set of fundamental epistemological considerations about, like, what is information, what is knowledge, what is true and verifiable information, what's bullshit. So I like a lot of his stuff, and he's got a TED Talk. If you look Michael Lynch, you can find that. Other people, Will McCaskill's stuff is good on effective altruism. I think he has a lot of nuanced views. He's on Joe Rogan too. Mm-hmm. And Peter Boghossian is also, he's a epistemologist out at University of Oregon, but he's also a jiu-jitsu practitioner. Oh, nice. So he was on the Joe Rogan show talking about how getting choked out really, it forces you to deal with reality in a way that traditional martial arts, just doing kata, never does.
So those are three. I've been there
a lot. Yeah. Yeah, me too, man. Those are three philosophers that are in the public sphere that I wish would get more attention. So I would direct people's attention to that.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks for coming on today. Great discussion. And definitely check out the Homo Furens podcast. I think that's awesome. We had, if you didn't check out the last episode with Michael and Bob Underwood, we'll put a link to that up in the show notes as well. Yeah, man, thanks for coming on here. And to everybody out there, I mean, it's a brave new world. Navigate it wisely. Yep. That's, I guess, what I would say. Get out there and live your best lives while you can.
Cool. All right. Thanks, man.